important to help as the ability to make a friend and be a friend. Friendship is a greater treasure than can ever be put in a bank balance. But we do not realize this, and we have great trouble because of the banks and because of the system and because that's the way it's done. But how it happens that we have built a great system all over this world, drawing in not only the more powerful nations, but the unfolding and growing nations, to become part of a fatal situation in which there is no consideration for value. Everything is in terms of profit. And every bit of profit today is measured in terms of loss. So we are not getting there. Now, that somebody 2,500 years ago should point out why we're not getting there now is very interesting, especially as it is not directly involved with preachment as we know it. It is not a case of trying to ask forgiveness for our sins. It's a problem of outgrowing them by our own efforts. It puts growth largely with the person. But the reward of growth by the person is the unfoldment of the potentials of that person. The individual who wishes to face eternity with a good hope has got to build a good life to face it with. So in the terms of the path that leads to the end of suffering, we can quietly detach ourselves through thoughtfulness. Now, Buddhism is a way of thoughtfulness that is not based upon platitudes. We all hear people tell us what to do, and we usually resent them. We are particularly resentful and take refuge in the concept that they tell us what to do, but they're not doing it themselves, and therefore it doesn't mean anything. Maybe it does mean something, but we have a perfect way of rejecting it because the other person isn't fulfilling his own philosophy. But in Buddhism, you do not have this situation at all because you do not derive authority from other individuals. You derive authority from the one immutable source of authority, nature itself. You learn from living, not being told how to live, but seeing the consequences of your own living. You grow by watching the results of your own action. You unfold because you gradually become aware that it is necessary, not because someone else tells you. You discover the importance of the golden rule, because when you have broken it time after time, you have suffered. So that the final authority in the struggle against suffering is to estimate the consequences of suffering on your own flesh. Of course, you can broaden the scheme a little bit and observe how actions similar to yours by other persons is bringing them suffering. You can gradually come to realize that there are rules, there is a way of life that is acceptable to nature, and nature will never give peace or happiness or friendship until its ways are accepted and followed. This is a very important discovery, but I like the part particularly that it is an experience pattern. That we are not forced to do something because the wise have told us to. We are not forced to do it because our faith demands it. We do it because we cannot survive any other way. And we are becoming increasingly weary of not surviving. We are not having what we should have from a world that can provide us with everything that we need, if, as individuals, we do not break the rules of nature and the rules of supply and demand. If we are willing to free ourselves from the terrible struggle of what we might term a materialistic culture, we will not only have better health, better homes, but we will also have a little time left to do something significant. We will have a time to sit down and read a good book. We will have time to go out and help a friend in trouble. We will have time to do many gracious things. But these gracious things are all being sacrificed on the altar of immediate utility. And as a result, we go along until we reach the end, and then perhaps a few hours before we depart, we begin to wonder what it's all about. It is not right for generation after generation of little ones to come into this world without some hope that they will receive the proper instruction necessary to give them a good and happy life. This is something we all have to work on if we expect it to happen. Now, in the course of this good and better and helpful life, there are rules also of things we have to do. One of the rules that Buddhism points out is that the individual, in order to gain the good of his own life, has to gradually take part in the labors of nature. Just as he must weed his own garden if he wants to raise vegetables, so he must help to weed life if he wishes to enjoy the beauties and niceties of existence. He has a community to consider, a community which is allowed to run down, go to pieces. He has a way of environment in neighborhood and in family and in friends, in which he can create gradually a greater amount of beauty, faith, insight, understanding, and security. So we are all gardeners in the world. We are none of us owners of anything. Buddha points that out very clearly in his thinking. We are not owners. We never have anything except a temporary leasehold. We are permitted to have things, but we cannot possess them. And now Buddha brings out the problem of wealth. He was not one of those who thinks we should take everything we have and distribute it among the poor. He said, this is not right because this is not the way nature does it. Nature distributes nothing but gives the individual the right to earn anything he wants. It is not to be bountiful that counts. And Buddha said, remember that it isn't the money. Money isn't anything except a medium of exchange. It isn't good. It isn't bad. It is no more significant in itself than a pebble on the beach or a shell in the ocean. It is not what you have. It is what you do with what you have. It's the attitude of possession. If you begin to think of wealth and money as possession, yours, to do with as you please, then gradually money becomes a curse. It becomes more and more of a curse when we give it an authority over life, which it never is entitled to. Croesus in antiquity was said to have been the richest man who ever lived. And one day he showed his treasure house to a philosopher. And the philosopher said to him, Croesus, all that gold can be taken from you by a man with more iron. And it so happened. It is always the fact that wealth in itself is a great danger because it increases cupidities and contributes to conflict everywhere. If we had the concept within ourselves that Buddhism teaches, that wealth is something that at best is loaned to us, it is something that for a little time we are able to administer. But that in the administration of it, justice must be the first consideration. Justice with mercy, with love, with insight, and with unselfish understanding. Properly administered, wealth becomes a form of positive growth because it shows that the individual has transcended himself. But wealth dedicated to the advancement of individual projects at the cost of the common good is a sin and will lead to an inevitable accumulation of crimes. So it is not what we have, but what we do with it that determines whether we have peace or we have suffering. Every step of the way, there is a right use that brings peace. In every field of endeavor, there is a wrong use that ends in suffering. And we can't really solve this thing until we begin to estimate the universe in larger terms. Like Christianity, Buddhism had no cosmogony. Originally, Buddhism did not discuss the nature of the infinite or the vast concatenations of worlds. These concepts were in the keeping of the Brahmins, who were the great scientists of Asia. But gradually, with the passing of time, Buddhism divided into two great schools, one of which, the Theravada, or the school we might say of strict observances, moved southward in Asia and has its great centers in Thailand and in Lanka and these areas. The other system, the Mahayana, went northward into Tibet and China and finally into Japan and Korea. In this school, cosmogony is introduced from the Hindu, and the days of creation for the Mahayana school are measured much in the same way that Christianity measures creation from the book of Genesis. It was the background for a vast concept of life. Add to the Brahmins reincarnation, which they already taught, and karma. Add to that also the mathematical exactness of their calculations of the great cycles of space. Then add to that the law that we find in Buddhism of eternal progress towards infinite at-one-ment with reality. And you have a universe in which no one can afford to be selfish. The individual who, being a materialist, feels that when he passes from here, no one is going to care, and he is no longer going to know that he ever existed. This seems to be one end of suffering, oblivion. But to work as hard as he does, and use the faculties that he possesses, and bearing witness to a tremendous evolutionary background, which has brought him to the present condition, and then assume that he is exterminated, is something the Eastern mind has a great deal of difficulty with. It cannot accept the idea that all this great growth, this tremendous pageantry of evolving life, not only here but in the evolution of stars and suns and galaxies, that all this means nothing, that has no purpose, no reality, and that everything is going to begin and end in the form of cosmic dust. They cannot accept this. So the philosophical systems and nations have always assumed that there is survival, and that survival is subject to certain penalties. In some religions, those who have been naughty, when they leave here, roast in perdition for an unlimited period of time. This concept has lost interest for most people. It is no longer believed. And even in the old days where the beginnings of the belief can be traced, it was intended as symbolical. It was not intended to indicate a literal place. The individual is not intended to roast in perdition. But he must have a kind of purgatory, which is perhaps even more painful in the long run. He must live with himself. He must face the consequences of his own conduct. He must become aware of the misery he has caused. He must realize also how he has frustrated his own growth, how he has destroyed a valuable experience pattern which should have made him a better person. Instead of that, has left him sorrier than before. So what we have thought of as purgatory or perdition is really the inevitable facing of self, the inevitable continuance of an unfinished business until we finish it. Plato pointed out that there could never be a perdition worse than here, that right here in this world is hell, and that all of us come back to it until we learn to be better. But it is possible through integrity to transform hell itself. It is only bad because it is a place where we are required to face the consequences of our own conduct. As our own conduct changes, as our own consequences are regenerated, this world can be what it was intended to be. But in order to be a beautiful world, the beings that come back into it must have achieved within themselves a quality of integrity that makes it impossible for them to pervert or destroy the natural order of things. We have the right to make whatever we deserve and live in the results of our own conduct. So Buddhism, with the addition of reincarnation and in the Northern School, gives us a great concept of life, a concept of life that in no way conflicts with modern astronomy, because it deals with a dimension which astronomy never touches. In fact, astronomy is apt to completely deny. It has to do with qualitative cosmogony. It has to do with the universe as experience, the universe as wisdom, as love, of strength, and of beauty. It is a universe that science cannot touch, but to which it could also elevate itself if it so desired. There's no reason why the scientist could not be a great mystic or a great spiritual leader, because both the material and the spiritual are locked within himself. He is that which he has released at the present time. That which is yet to be released can cause him also to be not only a scientist but a saint if he wants to be. So everywhere in this world there is this constant struggle to get hold of the values by means of which we can escape the tyrannies of circumstance. Also in this same thought, knowing the mind, as the Bhagavad Gita says, and no doubt Buddha read that in his own day, the mind is the slayer of the real. The mind is very largely responsible for the trouble. It is not responsible because it is bad. There's nothing bad about a mind. But a mind misused can be the most dangerous thing in all the world. A mind that is not refined and regenerated by love and friendship is completely a despot, a tyrant. And it leads the owner of that mind to destruction in almost every instance. There is nothing that adds more to the suffering of the individual than the misuse of his own mind. To recover from this misuse does not mean that the individual should cease to think. But he should begin to think in terms of value. He should think with the universe instead of against it. He should think of those things necessary to the common good and not those things which destroy the common good. The mind can be a magnificent and beautiful instrument. It can also be a terrible thing. And in the illumination of Buddha under the Bodhi tree, it is said that there was a kind of an atomic fission, a tremendous explosion of energy, of mind within him. It was the mind that became the universal energy and overcame the personal. Universal mind, more or less, was given the right to manifest through him. He gave it that right himself. Buddha never claimed to be an avatar, never claimed to be a god, never claimed to be an agent of God. Buddha never claimed to be anything but a simple human being who, looking around and seeing what was happening, thought something ought to be done about it. And in order to create his philosophy, he accepted nothing that was not demonstrable to him in the simple course of his own lifetime. For 80 years, He wandered the roads and paths of Bengal. And during that time, he saw every type of experience of which the individual is capable of enduring. He saw birth, he saw growth, he saw death. He found all the different scenes and sights and symbols of human achievement and decay. He saw great palaces filled with misery. He saw hovels with joy and beauty. He saw the wise and the semi-wise and the unwise. He saw the sophisticated and the natural and simple childlike person. He experienced all of these things, and he had to fit it in, all of it, into one great comprehensive plan. A plan which man can intuit. A plan which man may not fully understand, but one thing he can understand. Namely, he knows when he breaks it. He knows when he does wrong. And from constantly learning what is wrong, he must ultimately gain the inner vision to know what is right. And he knows that what is right is harmless. That what is right protects every part of the person. And those who followed in his path, his arhats and their disciples, gradually reduced the power of pain and misery in themselves. There is a painting in the back of the lecture hall here on the Nirvana of the Buddha, a Japanese rendering of an ancient Chinese painting. Here the master is lying on a couch of death, surrounded by his disciples. The disciples are all sad, looking greatly deprived, except Ananda. Ananda is looking up through the sorrow of the others, smiling beautifully. Ananda knows the truth. And in that in itself, we have the mystery of the loss of suffering due to the sense of loss. Ananda knew the truth about the passing of the master. Therefore, he did not suffer. Buddha knew the mystery of all things that change, and therefore, the transition is to be met in peace and understanding and charity and insight and kindness and forgiveness. He also taught that every grudge can be likened to a psychological germ bringing sickness to those who hold it. Every prejudice, every unreasonable attitude, any pressureful or extreme attitude, even one of a highly spiritual nature, must be carefully examined. Where the person loses his inner poise and expresses an emotion or an attitude that is excessive, there is too much pressure. And what is pressure? Pressure is a cause of suffering. Wherever there is pressure, there will be suffering. Now, nature has provided man with a certain equipment to protect him from suffering. He has resources within the endocrine system, particularly in the suprarenals, which enable him to meet a stressful situation with poise and dignity. But if this stress goes on year by year and he never controls himself, the resources of the body are exhausted and it begins to fail under an abuse of attitudes. Man can destroy his own body by abusing with his attitudes that body. So everywhere the individual must learn to reduce stress. I have noticed in talking with people that nearly always they get excited when they're wrong. They become more pressureful. They do not realize this. But they become defensive. If they are right, it needs no defense. The Buddhist philosophy says if you're right, you don't have to defend. If you're wrong, you can't defend. Therefore, keep quiet and behave yourself. This is very useful. It saves energy. And it would probably add from 5 to 10 years to every person's life in a comparatively healthy condition if he would stop abusing his own attitudes. If he would prevent himself from hating, disliking, grudging. if he would stop blaming this and blaming that and settle down to being what he ought to be, his health would improve and would be possible, very likely, to balance the national budget on this point alone. Because think how much we could save in welfare and Medicare and old age pensions if people were happy, busy, and productive to the end of life. It would not be the same type of world. And we are wearing out this world by simply abusing every resource there is in it. And then when we try to correct the situation, everyone hates us and organizes to maintain the corruptions. Therefore, you cannot do it that way. The only way you can do it is to recognize an over-government or an over-world that must be obeyed. In Buddhism, as Dr. Anasaki, who was an expert on Buddhist symbolic art in Japan, observed, the universe of Buddhism is not a kingdom. The universe of Buddhism is a commonwealth. Buddhism does not teach a tyranny of executive force anywhere in the universe. It is indeed a commonwealth which is created as it is created in order that it may gradually become a psychically socialized existence. The commonwealth of the world, of the universe, of cosmos, is also interpreted in the forms of a cosmotheism. Namely, that existence itself, this vast expanse, is all of it an expression of the divine mind. The universal thought produces it all. The universal thought is eternal and can never be wrong. The universal thought has unfolded through every form of life that is known to us. Every thought, every form is one of the temporary passing musings of an eternal thinker. This vast theism is absolutely organized. But it is organized not by an artificial mind forcing organization upon it. It is organized because every atom is organized in its own structure. Organization is inherent in any structure that exists in nature, from the smallest microbe to the vastest galaxy. These things do not have law and order thrust upon them by an external power. That law and order of their kind is within themselves, eternal, inevitable, unchangeable. And that law and order asks and requires and demands the fulfillment of its own purpose. And when the law and order in the living things becomes the rule of those things grow, live, and fulfill themselves. When they go against the plan is so much bigger than they are that they do not have a chance of success. They can never succeed except by obeying not somebody else's will, but the eternal within themselves, which is properly integrated for the species to which they belong. Humanity has its own laws. It has its own rights. It has its own purposes. And these are inherent in every human being. They're in every cell of the body and in the great compound of the cells, which we call the personality. All these things are moved by rules. Rules which are intended for only one purpose, to prevent suffering. If man himself continues to abuse these rules and causes suffering, then the rules still operate because they begin to point out the law and the path that leads to the end of suffering. The individual who suffers from a mistake must recover by correcting the mistake. If you have a certain physical ailment that is annoying or something, you go to your doctor, and he tells you not to do this or to do that, and you will feel better. In nature, you don't get someone telling you. But through experience, you make a mistake, and it hurts. You make a mistake in selecting of a friend, and the friend isn't true to you. And you must ask yourself what caused you to select for your friend a person who wasn't worthy. And the chances are, 100 to 1, you will find that you chose that person because that person apparently was going to be serviceable to you for some purpose. That you made the friend to advantage something of your own. And therefore you were deceived. You deceived yourself by allowing your motives to blind you to your integrities. All these things become part of a strong Buddhist philosophy of life. They are part of the way in which the doctrine has descended and probably will, in one way or another, be absorbed into practically every culture that we know. It conspires against nothing. It is not basically a creed. It doesn't even need to be named. It is not something that was dreamed up by a person. It is merely the ability of the individual to understand his own nature and to find out how he operates by watching himself operate. He must serve apprentice to his own principles in order to learn. And when he sees that he is not getting the results that are good for him, he must change his ways. And he will find nearly always that when he realizes that he needs to change his ways, what he ought to do will become apparent to him. Nature is not a tyrant. It is a very generous and indulgent power. But it has a great project. And that project is to perfect all creation and bring it back again into harmony with an infinite eternal plan. So that in order to fulfill these purposes, each rational thing has to work out its own salvation with diligence. These were the last words of the Buddha. And we all have to live by them. Work out our own salvation. Not necessarily for our own glory, but in order that we may become part of a plan that needs us. Every single human being is part of a plan, and that plan calls for the fulfillment of life in everything, the final achievement of the rectification of character in every living thing. The birds and the bees and the animals have their characters which must be rectified. Man has his character, and according to the Buddhist beliefs, the universe is full of unfolding evolutionary processes, where millions and myriads of forms of life unfolding and perfecting themselves according to the laws of existence. To discover these laws is the first labor of the wise. To live them is the first constructive relationship that we can have with eternal purposes. And if we do these things and do them correctly, our lives will be far more gentle. The only thing we have to do is gradually weed out those actions of our own which are detrimental to us and others. And by doing this, we shall come in the end to a very much better and happier relationship with ourselves and with those around us, and we can build a civilization that has a chance of enduring. Well, I guess that's all for this morning. I'd like to...